Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil sends the beast with wrath, because he knows the time is short. Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
Welcome to episode number 6 of the Iron Maiden podcast. This one's called 666, and it's aptly named because review Iron Maiden's most legendary album, The Number of the Beast. Definitely one of my favorite albums by the band. And also, we have a really, really big announcement coming up on this show, which is Sean Muse from Run to the Hills, the tribute band to Iron Maiden, is going to be co-hosting the show with me from now on. So, congratulations, Sean. You're on the show for good now. How do you feel?
Hello, this is Bruce Dickinson. Hi, this is Sean Muse, Run to the Hills Iron Maiden tribute band from the United States of America, New England portion. I am very honored and pleased to be co-host with you, Rowan. And I must say it's always a joy and a pleasure to do this with you. And to all you Iron Maiden fans out there, I promise that I will do everything I can to be fun and stimulating on these podcasts, so that when you're driving around with this on your iPod or wherever you're at, that you find that it's just a great way to kill time.
All right, really cool, Sean. It's great to have you on the show as a co-host, and I think we've got some awesome episodes to come, and it'd be really great doing them with you. So let's get started then. Today's episode, like I said earlier, is based on The Number of the Beast, one of Maiden's most legendary albums, and definitely, I think, heavy metal's most legendary album, one of the best albums that, you know, we've got out there, it defines heavy metal. So today's episode is dedicated to The Number of the Beast, one of my favorite albums by the band. And so we're going to get started on the making of The Number of the Beast, and also how this was Bruce's first album with the band, how he got recruited into the band, the entire process. So Sean, would you like to say anything about how Bruce got recruited into the band, and you know, a little on the making of the album?
Yes, this all started back, really going back to 1980. As you probably know, Bruce Dickinson had a recording career before Iron Maiden. It was in a band called Samson, and they inevitably played many of the same clubs. So what happened was Iron Maiden and Samson would see each other play live and so on and so on. And actually they recorded in this adjacent studios in 81. So I'll start the story from there. Steve Harris had long been a fan of Bruce Dickinson's vocals, and Bruce had been a long time fan of the direction the Maiden were going for music-wise. For him, it reminded them of Deep Purple, which was his favorite band. And this kind of started off when they were recording Killers, and Samson was recording their Shock Tactics albums, both great albums, by the way. And he noticed that there was starting to become some issues with Paul. The musical direction wasn't to Paul's liking. At the same time, the band were getting a little frustrated with some of the issues with Paul as far as having to cancel dates and whatnot. So really, during 81, on the Killers tour, Maiden realized that they had to make a change, that they wanted to go in a different direction. And of course, Bruce was somebody that they had their eye on. So what happened was, Samson by this time had been going down the tubes in terms of the management. They fired them. They were having all kinds of legal issues, but they were playing at the Reading Festival, which was a very big festival for many years in England. And Steve Harris, Rod Smallwood, and a couple others decided to actually go to Reading to see Samson play that day, and to, you know, kind of feel out and see if Bruce had any interest in auditioning for the band. So that's what they did. All of you out there need to go out and buy Live at Reading 81 by Samson. It is an amazing CD. In my humble opinion, the best vocal performance by any heavy metal singer ever recorded live. And this is including in Bruce's entire career. This is his absolute peak. So check it out. They did a set, and then afterwards, the famous story where Rod and Bruce are the only ones under a spotlight in a tent area in the backstage. Everybody's watching them talk. And Rod essentially asked Bruce if he'd like to audition for the band. And Bruce, being understandably very confident, said, sure. And when I do that, I'm going to get the job. So let's talk about what happens next. And he says, oh, you better come back to the hotel with us. So that's what they did. They went back to the hotel. The next day, Bruce came in actually knowing many more songs than they expected, and they started playing right away. And they could just tell immediately they had something really, really special. And they actually got Bruce into the studio. They did four tracks in the studio. Remember Tomorrow, Killers, Twilight Zone, and Wrathchild. And it just floored everybody. And very quickly they said, well, Bruce is in the band, and it was a big thing. So what happened was Maiden had dared to make a change to the frontman, which is a huge gamble. To break Bruce in, what they did was they made up some dates in Italy in 81. And in Italy, they played, his first gig was on October 26, 81 in Bologna, and then they did four other dates in Italy. And then the big test was back in England. They did their first gig with Bruce at the Rainbow Theater in November 15, 81. And here's the interesting thing. Besides Bruce doing an amazing performance and just fitting in right away, blowing the fans away, what happened was they had already started writing new material for The Number of the Beast, because at this gig, for the first time, and some of you know this, they have this, and I'm fortunate enough to have many Iron Maiden bootlegs, including this one. They actually, for the first time, played Children of the Damned and also 22 Acacia Avenue on November 15th, 1981, about 3 months before, actually almost 4 months before The Number of the Beast even came out. And it's some slightly altered lyrics and whatnot, but amazing. And then in December of 81, by then they had written a lot more of the material, of course. They, for the first time, they played at Ruskin Arms on December 23rd, 81. For the first time, they played Run to the Hills and The Prisoner. And amazing versions of these. And again, this was a holy grail for many years for us to get this gig. And again, I have it, and you've got to hear it. It's unbelievable. So what happened was, coincidentally, Iron Maiden, after they finished Killers, were out of material. So they had a brand new singer who, for legal reasons, couldn't officially be credited, but he actually had a lot of input on shaping the vocal melodies and the material. They had to write all this new material. So The Number of the Beast took on a whole new complexity and direction from the first two albums. Unfortunately, what they gained on writing the material, they had some issues technically, and some of those stories are famous. Equipment breaking down, doing funny things. The famous story of Martin Birch, their producer, getting in an auto accident, and then the bill being 666.
Exactly,
points.
Yeah.
Strange things are happening. But what happened was they had to pick a single because they wanted to get some buzz going, and they picked, of course, they made the good decision to Run to the Hills. And maybe not such a good decision on B-side. They couldn't fit in the album at the time, Total Eclipse, which I'm happy to say, we'll talk about this later. Now it's on the album because, the technology allows you to fit everything. They mixed those. Run the Hills sounded good, but the other mixes just didn't really stand up. So what happened was they just simply ran out of time, and Steve Harris put his foot down and gave Martin the time he needed. Now, this had a result of the band putting out the Number of the Beast album later than they originally wanted to be. Because originally they wanted to get it out and then do their tour in England, the start of the Beast on the Road tour, which kicked off at the very end of February. And what happened was it ended up coming out right after they finished the tour at the Hammersmith Odeon. I think it was like March 22nd of 82. It came out late because they needed more time to get it mixed and whatnot. The album went straight in at number one. And the rest is history. I will say this about The Number of the Beast before we dive into the songs. In my opinion, it is the best Iron Maiden album. I love that it has Bruce's vocals, which from 81, 82 is certainly his peak vocal period. And as a matter of fact, vocal period for any metal singer ever. This is arguably the best heavy metal album ever. For anyone that's a singer, particularly, I know there's those that can argue certain ones from Metallica, Sabbath, et cetera, but this just has a perfect blend of those air raid siren vocals, the energy of a young band writing material that's new to them, even just unbelievable stuff. So that's really kind of the behind the scenes. It really all started in '81, and then bang, 1982, they put this album out, and off they go.
Exactly. It was basically the first album where actually all band members got together and actually sat down wrote songs together. So I think for a first album, Maiden definitely created history. And I think they walked out of the studio not knowing that they actually created history, as Adrian Smith rightly said. You know, they just thought they made a good album, but it definitely, you know, proved to be better than good. And I think it's definitely one of the greatest heavy metal albums of all time. And that's the reason why Went Platinum also debuted at number one in the UK. So definitely a very, very strong album. Again, to start off with the album and review it track by track, as what we plan to do on this episode. It starts off in a very, very great way with The Invaders, which is, I think, a fantastic way to start off the album. Now, this song may have not got the recognition that it deserved. It's not one of those popular songs that Maiden play live or, you know. But I think a large portion of Maiden fans, especially fans who consider The Number of the Beast as their favorite album, definitely enjoy the song. And it's a great way to start off the album. Again, some great drumming by Clive Burr, and some of the bass lines in this album are extraordinary. So, and also, like I was going to say, the production, which was an essential part, Martin Birch outdid himself, I think, on this album, and it's got some really, really strong production. So again, getting back to Invaders, a fantastic way to open the album. It's got some real soul. Bruce Dickinson, again, hitting some really, really classic notes of his, where he, you know, notes that, you know, I think very few heavy metal vocalists could hit, you know, some that I know of being Rob Halford from Judas Priest. But apart from that, I don't think there are, you know, many heavy metal vocalists that could actually, you know, hit notes like that. So Bruce Dickinson coming out with an absolutely fantastic, vocals on the first track. So all in all, a great way to open the album, and I think a very strong song also, even though it may have not got the recognition that it deserved. What's your take on it?
Well, Mick Wall says it best in his autobiography of Iron Maiden, that Bruce Dickinson has the magical ability to take the most convoluted lyric and make it sexy. I mean, Invaders is a great example where he takes, you know, Longboat's have been cited, blah, 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 and he makes it sound really hummable and enjoyable. So even more than hitting notes, Bruce has this amazing ability to insert melody lines. And by the way, I must give Steve Harris credit, because Steve Harris writes the brunt of the material, and he actually comes in with ideas on the leads and also even the vocal melodies. So Steve has to get in on that credit. But Invaders is a very powerful song. They never played it live. Now, we have. We actually, going back about 3 years ago, we actually played the Number of the Beast album from start to finish with all the songs, including Total Eclipse. The power of Invaders live is amazing, and it's a shame they never get around to playing it. To this day, the band themselves, they're just not big fans of it. I think the biggest beef is just kind of the oddball chorus on it. I'm finding that most of the Iron Maiden fans think it's a killer song. And it's a great way to start the album, because it's very, you know, it really gets into it. It's really very bloodthirsty, and it's up-tempo, and it's really a big announcement that, hey, here's our new singer, and check this out.
I think it's got a really good blend of metal in it, and I think it's, like I said, it's a great album opener, and, you know, most of Maiden's album openers are really great, but this one's a really great opener that actually doesn't get the recognition that it deserved. It was written by Steve Harris, this song. Moving on from Invaders, the second song on the album, Children of the Damned. And this is a brilliant song. It's this mournful, dramatic, slow song that's, I mean, it's got such soul to it. The song is absolutely brilliant. And when I say dramatic, I say it's unashamedly dramatic. It's a brilliant song. And, you know, I think the songwriting on the song is amazing. You know, just everything about the song, it's so, so cool. And I think this album, this song's been played live many times. It was actually played the last time being on the fourth leg of the Somewhere Back in Time World Tour. So again, like I said, this song is a great live song. It sounded really great on the album. I just wish they would play the acoustic parts on acoustic guitars live. But nonetheless, I still think it's a really, really great song. And again, you know, just this just shows a classic album. You know, you're into the second song and you're already in love with the album. So I think Children of the Damned, another great song on the album. What exactly are your thoughts on it?
Well, this song sounds very different live. Even on the Beast on the Road tour, And perhaps it's because, for example, the acoustic guitars, the album version is strong and it has a nice texture to it. Live, this song is really a good example of how you can capture more of the intent of the song in a live setting. For instance, if you, and I'm sure most of the fans that are listening to this have seen the Beast on the Road video from the Hammersmith Odeon, this is one of the highlights of the entire set. They got the fog going. They've got the whole atmosphere going on. Of course, Bruce's vocals are just unbelievable on the live version. As a matter of fact, I would say it sounds better than the album itself. But on the album, what's neat about this song is it's very much different from anything else on the album. And most people have at some point held those lighters up in the air while it's playing. It's definitely that type of song.
Exactly.
Heavy.
It's this song that's got this really cool feel to it. I mean, it's like one of those songs that it's sort of like it's a ballady song. Not exactly a ballad, but, you know, it's got like this perfect, like, again, a very good blend of metal and sort of rock and roll. And so yeah. I think it's
a spiritual predecessor is off the newest album, the song Coming Home, which we talked about in the last episode from The Final Frontier.
Uh-huh.
Very much has a feel that's similar to Children of the Damned in some spots when they do the acoustics. The thing about this song is that it's a very dark song as far as lyrics and whatnot, but yet there's some kind of a feel-good quality about it that comes through.
Uh-huh.
It's one of my favorites to sing when we do the tribute act. It's one of those songs that everyone seems to really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. All right, so, again, a great song.
We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
And on to The Prisoner. This song has a lovely, warm, put your fist up in the air chorus for all us metal brethren. Famous story behind this, of course, is it's based on the television show of the same name in England. As a matter of fact, the band had to get permission from Patrick McGoohan, the star of the show, to use the intro they used on the song, which they all sat around nervously as Rod Smallwood called them up and what do you say the name of the band was again? Says Iron Maiden. And he says, do it, and he hangs up the phone. So that's pretty cool that they used that intro, and probably Clive Burr's shining moment as a drummer in the band is the way he kicks into that beat. It's got a real swagger to it, and the consensus, it seems, with all the Maiden fans is this song is really defined a lot by the guitar riff. That opening riff really drives throughout the song. And again, very fun to sing, tough one to sing too. It's in an unusual key, as the whole album as a general has the same key, but the way Bruce approaches the chorus on it is very hummable, of course. Unfortunately, not played too much. I mean, it was played throughout the Beast Tour, of course, and they played it on the Seventh Son of a Seven Son Tour. And then I don't think they've played it since. Although I did, I remember I spent time about a week and a half on the road during Bruce Dickinson's Accident of the Birth Tour in 97. And he was playing this song as well. So this is one of those classic Bruce and Adrian compilations with Harris, of course. But the song, I would have to say it's one of the best kept secrets on the album for those who aren't a hardcore fan. Meaning if you said, oh yeah, I like some Maiden, they might not know about this song. But anybody that's a real big time Maiden fan loves this song.
Exactly, I have to agree with you on that. The song's got this really cool, drum intro to it, and then, the guitars just kick in, and it sounds so cool. It's got this real, heavy metal, rock and roll sort of vibe to it. So, I mean, on the whole, the song sounds really good. The bass lines in the song are really cool. And again, I think it's not just this song, but every song on the album, again, Bruce has just done a fantastic job. So The Prisoner for me was like an amazing song, and I really enjoyed the performance that they put out, which was on Beast Over Hammersmith, and you know, it was really, really cool, especially the guitar solo by Adrian and Dave. So I think on the whole, the song's been really, really cool. You know, well composed, and again, it's written by Adrian Smith and Steve Harris, whom I think, you know, have this really cool understanding when it comes to writing songs. And you know, I generally really enjoy songs written by Adrian Smith and Steve Harris, especially of the newer albums also. So I think all in all, The Prisoner was a really great track on this album.
And once again, the band was very excited about it when they wrote it. As I said earlier, they actually played this well before they put out the album on the Killers tour. They did that date on, again, it was December 23rd, 1981. They played The Prisoner at the Ruskin Arms. The thing about it is they didn't have the intro yet, and the song ends differently. And this version is really fun to listen to. There's a couple slightly different vocal approaches on it as well. And I would have to say that the feedback I get over here in the States from people that are big time into this album, this tends to be one of their favorite songs for sure. And moving right along, if I may, to 22 Acacia Avenue, still a crowd favorite. Song actually originated with Adrian Smith when he was an urchin. Steve Harris remembered the riffs from it, and he asked Adrian about it, and Adrian said, "Oh yeah, that's this song." And Steve Harris, of course, put his stamp on it and added in some material. This song was premiered once again in November 15th, 1981 at the Rainbow Theater in London. This was a full 4 months before the album even came out. And the thing about this song, I would have to say this song is very atypical for an Iron Maiden song. And it's kind of obvious because, again, it wasn't originated by Steve Harris. It was originated by somebody else. And thus, this song is a welcome addition to the Number of the Beast album. The thing about it too, the story is, of course, it's kind of a sequel to Charlotte the Harlot. And for a good year and a half on tour, Iron Maiden on a nightly basis during the song would have a woman come out as Charlotte the Harlot and dance for the crowd. And what that kept going until there was an unfortunate incident in Buffalo, New York on the Peace of Mind tour in 83 where apparently situation had happened between Bruce Dickinson and the person who was acting as Charlotte that night on the stage. And I'm not going to get into great detail, but from that point forward, the band discontinued doing that. The song itself, everyone I talked to, at least over here, is very fond of the Adrian Smith solos and the Dave Murray solos. They also like the breakdown in the song. I can tell you from experience that singing it, it's one of like three or four songs that has been, I think, in every single set list that I've ever done. And that this is going all the way back to 97, when we used to be called Killers. And I think that there's two big reasons. First off, it's an awesome song, but secondly, it's very enjoyable to perform. Iron Maiden has done it a bunch of different times. Of course, they did it on the Beast Tour, Peace of Mind Tour, Power Slave Tour. I think they brought it back, if I remember correctly, for the No Prayer for the Dying Tour. They did it on the Early Days Tour, and I'm going to speculate that it'll make its appearance known again at some point.
Actually, they did play it recently on the Somewhere Back in Time World Tour. I think they played on the final leg of the Somewhere Back in Time World Tour. So I think, I don't know if it was played on the other legs because the set list kept changing on different legs. So I think the song was actually played on the Somewhere Back in Time World Tour. Apart from that, it's a really great sequel to the song, Charlotte the Harlot. And Charlotte the Harlot was actually written by Dave Murray. And I think, you know, the fact that Steve actually, you know, heard the song from Merchant, and, you know, he thought it would, you know, it would go well as a Maiden song. So he asked Adrian Smith about it, and they both wrote this song together. So I think it's a great, really, really great sequel to the song Charlotte the Harlot. It's got these really cool riffs, especially the intro riff. which gives the song this raw heaviness, especially when Adrian plays it live. So I think it's a great way to start off the song, and again, a great sequel. The third, the sequel to Acacia Avenue, I guess, was Hooks in You, which was again written by Adrian Smith on the No Prayer for the Dying album. And I guess from there, it was from Here to Eternity. Anyway, that's Fear of the Dark. So, moving on from The Prisoner, 22 Acacia Avenue, we have The Number of the Beast, the title track of the album, and definitely, you know, one of my favorites on this album. This song has, you know, this really, really amazing intro into it where, you know, apparently Bruce had to do this intro a couple of, times, and he was really, really frustrated by the end of it. And apparently chairs were thrown across the studio because he was so frustrated, by doing the whole thing over and over again. But I think the album version, the way it turned out, was absolutely brilliant. You know, the way Bruce has, you know, done it on the album, it's absolutely brilliant. And you can see what Martin was actually aiming for, Martin Birch was aiming for out there. So, again, a great entrance, intro. And I love the way, Dave Murray and Steve, play the guitars out there in the intro. And again, this really deadly intro by Vincent Price, which actually makes, it gives you a feeling like the devil's actually, you know, speaking. So,
I have a question for you. Did you know that, and this is one of the, I guess, the neat things about YouTube, did you know you can hear that intro of Bruce singing just his vocals?
I actually didn't know that. I mean, I saw it on the classic album.
Go check it out. Everybody listening, and again, I'm not one for recommending any piracy or anything, but there's, I don't know how this happened. It's something to do with one of those video games, I guess. There's a vocals only track of Bruce Dickinson doing The Number of the Beast, the actual original studio recording. And if you want to hear just his singing on that song, in the beginning, you'll hear him doing that. You'll hear that world famous scream, which is the very definition of his air raid siren qualities. I stumbled on it. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Because again, as a tribute performer, one of our biggest responsibilities is to have some kind of accuracy to sound similar to, you know, whoever we're doing a tribute to. So one day I was just kind of thumbing through and I'm like, is this for real? And I put it on. I could not believe it. And it's actually a few other songs too, but we'll get into those in other episodes. I agree with you 100%. The Vincent Price intro, again, very famous. I mean, if I'm correct, and I think I am, every single Iron Maiden performance since this album came out has had The Number of the Beast on the set list.
Uh-huh.
I think this, along with probably, and we'll talk about the song later, Hallowed Be Thy Name and the song Iron Maiden, these are probably the three untouchable songs that could never come off an Iron Maiden set list.
Exactly. And, I mean, they actually deserve to be on there because they're such great tracks.
Oh, yeah, of course. And the thing about the song, too, is if you listen to the live version of it, particularly early on the Number of the Beast tour, the power of the song, like, for example, on the verses, is just staggering. Even compared to the studio recording, you can really hear Harris's bass coming through and just hard charging through it. The song is pretty much known by every Iron Maiden fan, and probably a lot of people that are casually into Iron Maiden. As the tribute band, it's a lot of fun to do because, again, it's one of those crowd participation songs where you do the, you know, six and they do the 6-6. The video came out, again, this is another video that got onto MTV over here in the States that helped to propel Iron Maiden for two reasons. First, those of us who appreciated the song itself and what the band were doing, their following was growing because of that, but also because of just how conservative some of us are over here in our churches and all over the place. They took to this right away as a target. And I remember growing up in these strict churches, this album cover and this song in particular was a lightning rod over here. of people talking about how Iron Maiden are Satanists and they're corrupting the nation. As Bruce said, corrupting the nation's youth. And I think Iron Maiden was pretty pleased as punters because this really drove their popularity even higher and it drove album sales. So it was a strange way to get more recognition, but this song was right at the center of it. Of course, as it's known by now, it's simply a recounting of a dream Steve Harris had after he had watched The Omen.
Exactly. It was actually written off a dream. And it was misinterpreted as a satanic song. I mean, I've grown up in a Catholic family, so I know how tight it really is when it comes to religion and stuff. And again, this song, I think, was targeted. I mean, just absolutely misinterpreted. And
Satan was a hot topic in 82. And I've been very lucky to hang out with the guys in Iron Maiden many, 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 many times. And they're just absolutely ordinary people that like to have a beer here and there. There's nothing that ever remotely suggests that they're into Satan or anything like that.
I guess half of the band members are Christians themselves. So
I know Nico. You know, Nico is. That's a whole different subject, but. The thing about this particular album is it was at the height of two things. It was at the height, the beginning of MTV over here, where videos was really, in general, a new phenomenon. So there was a huge excitement attached to watching MTV back then. And just the timing, Iron Maiden just happened to come out with this album, and this is the other video they put up besides Run to the Hills. And the second thing was it was also the height of the... I'll call it the Christian alliance against rock music, you know, where they were saying this is satanic and this and that and trying to. So those things coupled together really helped to launch or relaunch in some cases the career of many bands. And certainly Iron Maiden just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Moving on to the next song, which I'm not going to introduce. I'm going to let you introduce this song. And it's obviously, for obvious reasons.
Let me read it on the album list here. Okay, it's a song called Run to the Hills. I've never heard of it.
Neither have I, but that's exactly why I asked. Oh. To go ahead.
Now, Run to the Hills made Iron Maiden's career. They were building a nice following as far as doing killer, no pun intended, killer live shows throughout the world, opening up the bands and whatnot. MTV... over here in the States, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but over here in the United States, got a video from a band called Iron Maiden for a song called Run to the Hills. And I must insert here that this is still my favorite Iron Maiden song ever, and a lot of people's. And of course, it's that amazing chorus with a combination of an incredible natural range from Bruce, but also just a very hummable vocal line. The song's so popular that... 3 years ago, I have twin sons, they're six now. I was playing it in the car and they started singing along all of a sudden. That's how I know how good the chorus is. And you got 3-year-olds just start singing Run to the Hills. It's a pretty interesting sight. The video, of course, was pretty hodgepodge. It's just I'm doing a live performance early in the Beast Tour, actually, I think it was. And when that came out, the added exposure from MTV plus the song being a terrific choice for a single brought them huge curiosity and recognition in the United States. And of course, they came into the States mostly as a support act for various bands in 82. But that was really the beginning of them going huge globally. And going back to the song itself, there's actually a bunch of people out there that can't stand this song. And it really puzzles me. And they have issues from everything from the lyrics to kind of the... what they consider to be a very odd intro with the guitars and whatnot. But for the vast majority of the fans, myself included, the song is powerful, it's melodic, it's the kind of song that makes you pump your fist in the air. It just the way they do the gallop, there's probably no better choice of a song to have a gallop on than to have one about horses running and whatnot. And the consensus is live, on the Beast Tour, this was so popular that they actually played it third in their set usually. And huge, just absolutely huge. Again, the first big hit with Bruce, so there's a lot of sentimental value for the band themselves on it. And probably once again, with rare exception, one of those songs they play at every show. Although I think maybe in the last tour they didn't do it. And again, I can't blame them. They've played it five million times.
They did it on the Somewhere Back in Time World Tour. They didn't do the song, I guess, on the Final Frontier World Tour.
And again, if you're just joining us, I coincidentally sing in an Iron Maiden tribute band called Run to the Hills. And if you ask anyone that likes rock and metal in general about Iron Maiden, the one song that virtually everybody knows by name is Run to the Hills. And that's why, because we used to be called Killers, and we changed the name in 2002. And I did it for that reason, because I just wanted to have that instant recognition for that song title. The song, singing-wise, is understandably incredibly difficult to sing like the album. Not so much hitting the notes, Rowan, but trying to hit the notes with that proper chest voice tone that Bruce has. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between that and just doing some falsetto thing, which, you know, anybody and their aunt or uncle could do. So that's one of those situations where, if it's done successfully, it's a very rewarding experience. The first time they ever played this was, again, December 23rd, 81. I have that recording. If you're wondering, Bruce sings it just like the album for the choruses, and it's unbelievable. You can hear the power in his voice. This song is just maybe one of the best heavy metal songs to exist anywhere ever.
Exactly. Actually, there's nothing much left for me to say, because you actually said it all, but again, this is like one of those Maiden anthems, a really, really great song that, you know, people who practically, I guess, you know, recognize Iron Maiden by the song, or the first thing that probably comes to your mind, apart from Eddie, when, you know, you say Iron Maiden, is Run to the Hills. So all in all, again, a really, really great song. And, you know, like you said, the intro, really great melody they have going there, the whole galloping part, and Dave's, again, an extraordinary solo by Dave. Which is actually one of the few solos that he actually never changes when he plays live, because I think he was really happy with what he came up with. So, again, I think a really, really good song. And Bruce, vocally, you know, outdid himself on this song. Absolute, you know, brilliance. So, again, I think one of Bruce's best songs in the album, and definitely one of my favorite Maiden songs. I actually can't believe that many Maiden fans don't like this song, but then again, I mean, it's a matter of opinion. So, personally, I feel this is one of Iron Maiden's best songs, and I hope they play it on every tour. It's, for me, it's probably like Fear of the Dark, the title track and Number of the Beast. You know, I can probably never get bored of it. So, you know, these three songs, Fear of the Dark, Iron Maiden, and Number of the Beast, I can really, really never get bored of listening to them. And even Run to the Hills, for that matter. So, they're, again, really, really great song. And I think, you know, a really smart decision to make it a single. And this single, you know, I think did the job for Maiden. And that, this is a song that actually put the Number of the Beast, you know, to its position in the UK, which was at number one. So I think, again, really great song. Moving to the next song on the album, which is Gangland. Now, I think this is the only song which Clive Burr has songwriting credits on. Clive Burr and Steve Harris. And I think this is the only song that Clive Burr wrote, and, you know, with his three albums with Iron Maiden. Again, it's I wouldn't call it my favorite on the album, but it's definitely a good song. For me, it would be, you know, one of the songs in the album that I didn't quite enjoy as much as the others. A very good song, there's no doubt about that, but I think the other songs, you know, the power that the other songs have sort of overshadow, you know, Gangland. That's my personal opinion.
Along with Invaders are the two that, you know, they're those two songs that the band never really embraced. A solid song, certainly not in the league of some of the other songs on the album, but nevertheless a very solid song. The drumming is very strong on it, of course, and you can kind of hear that how Clive had an influence. The consensus was the band at the time had wished they had put the next song on, which is actually on the CD now, Total Eclipse On, and made Gangland perhaps the B-side. Playing it live, Run the Hills again, we played the whole album straight through a few years ago. What was really cool is that a lot of the Maiden fans were really psyched to hear Invaders, and Gangland was another one that they've always wanted to hear live, because Maiden, again, has never played it. Very difficult song to sing. I mean, there's some really great screams in it and so on. It's kind of one of those forgotten songs, though, that never really got its recognition. And maybe just moving right into the next song here, Total Eclipse, which this is a song that took on a much better life live than on the recording. If you listen to the studio recording, it's much slower. It's still a great song. But if you compare that to the, for example, the Beast on the Road recording of the same song, it's not even close. And the funny thing about this song is I remember way back when Maiden first started showing footage from that Beast on the Road tour, they put out a video clip back, I think around 87, called 10 Wasted Years. The song was that was one of the clips they feature on it, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I went back and listened to the studio recording, which was not yet on the CD, and I was like, yeah, it's good, but oh my God, that live performance just blows it away. And the cool thing is, since CDs came out, Maiden finally just put it on the album. This one playing live was like, I think, one of the funnest songs to do.
It's exactly got that
real, almost like an Accept tone to it. You know, the band Accept and Priest, it kind of has that type of riffage going on. I think it's a very uncharacteristic song for Iron Maiden too.
Yeah, I actually agree with you on that. Yeah, but Total Eclipse is a song that sort of...
I don't even know who wrote it, but it's a really unusual song and very cool. To the live version. It's amazing.
Usually written, actually. It was written by Steve Harris, I think, Clive Burn, Dave Murray. And I don't know if Adrian Smith also had songwriting credits on it. But I'm pretty sure the first three did. So, again, it was written by three people. So definitely it's like a fusion of musical ideas that you have there, and that's why it sounds very different from you know, the rest of the album. So it definitely stands out from the other songs in the album, and like you said, yes, it definitely has a very different feel to it live than, you know, the other songs do. So I personally like this more. It's sort of like El Dorado. I mean, I haven't heard El Dorado live, but you know, from the feedback that I've got, you know, people generally tend to enjoy El Dorado live more than, you know, its studio version. So I'm guessing, you know, this is the same issue with Total Eclipse. A great song all in all. And moving to this was actually a B-side. You know, it didn't really make it to the album because of the, you know, space issue. But in the 1998 Masters, I think Maiden put it back on.
And they say that, of course, Bruce, at every Beast, I have, I don't know, about 55 dates from the Beast tour, just bootlegs that I listen to for enjoyment. And when any show that they headlined, which was all of England, Europe, the only place they really weren't headlining except for a couple of dates was the United States. When he introduced it, he said they should have been the album. They just didn't have the space. They played it virtually every time they headline as such. So they of course were big fans of the song.
Yeah, exactly. Like even in the Beast over Hammersmith gig, which I think the only gig that's actually released officially by Iron Maiden from the Beast on the Road tour, Bruce says it, like he rightly said, he said it, that there wasn't enough of space in the album, which is why they had to push it into the B-side. So technically it isn't really a B-side. But whatever, it came out in the 1998 remaster of the album, reissue of the album, sorry. So again, a great song. And then moving into the closing song of the album, which is, I think, you know, one of Maiden's... I think this is probably the best way Maiden has ever closed an album, which is Hallowed Be Thy Name. And this song, it actually brings, you know, shivers when you listen to some of the lyrics, which is, you know, the story of a condemned man's plea for forgiveness. So a brilliant, brilliant song. Some awesome writing. It's like one of those dark numbers that Maiden writes. written by Steve Harris. And I think, again, this is one of Maiden's best songs, you know, that they play live, I think, at almost every show. And the interesting thing about the song live is when, you know, Dave kicks in the solo right after Bruce, you know, does a little, you know, intro, and then he kicks right into the solo. And I think, you know, it sounds so cool live, this song. So again, this is probably one of the best songs in the album, definitely the strongest song. And I think, you know, the production on it, fantastic. Live also, the song is absolutely brilliant. And some great drumming by Clive Burr on this song, especially. So all in all, I think this song's a really, really good song. You know, some fantastic solos by Dave Murray and Adrian Smith. Now, the funny part about this is Dave Murray actually changes his solo on every tour for Hallowed Be Thy Name, whereas Adrian Smith sort of sticks to it. Now, Adrian Smith actually only played the solo till he was in the band, which was the last time being on the seventh tour. And after he rejoined the band, this solo has been, you know, played by Yannick Gers. And I think Yannick Gers actually really does justice to the solo, because I really like, you know, the little extended version of the solo. He's extended it a little. So I think that sounds really cool. So again, a great way to finish the album, and I think, you know, definitely one of Maiden's classics that, you know, definitely, you know, put them on, you know, the board and made them the band that they are today. I think, you know, this is one of the songs which, you know, every Maiden fan, you know, can't leave a concert without listening to. And rightfully so, one of my, you know, favorite Maiden songs of all time, Ash. What's your take on it?
Hallowed Be Thy Name is the best Iron Maiden song that exists.
I agree.
It's as simple as that. For a live recording, they play it every single show, and for good reason. I mean, every single show they play it. Playing it live, it's always a fan favorite. And the thing about it is the way it's recorded on the album is actually gives it the same justice as it does live. It's one of the rare studio recordings that is as good as when they play it live. Playing it live, of course, and again, I keep going back to the same thing. Coincidentally, certainly my favorite live recording ever of Maiden on video is the Beast over Hammersmith gig from 82. If you see the video for them performing Hallowed Be Thy Name, you'll see everything that's in that song, the different shapes and moods, the power of the music. Bruce's vocals, of course, are just, oh my God, unbelievable. And the funny thing about it is, and here's a great testament to it, gotta remind you that during that show, the album wasn't even out yet. So most of the material they played from the Beast album, the folks in the audience never even heard it. And you know how it is when you hear a song for the first time, it's tougher to get into it because you haven't heard it before. Watch the audience participation during that song, and at the end of it, how they give it a huge roar of approval. That's a great testament to how impactful this song is to everybody. Every single Iron Maiden fan I've ever met absolutely loves this song. Exactly. There is no debate whatsoever. None. There's not a single, and I've been doing this a long time, and I've been around fans for, you know, whatever, 30 years now being a fan. Every single Iron Maiden fan absolutely loves this song.
And exactly, this song is basically like a testament to Iron Maiden's, you know, domination in the heavy metal scene. And it's definitely one of those songs that, you know, metal bands, you know, basically take inspiration from. So
right. And not, I mean, the album in general, not any other band out there was making anything like this in 1982. There were some great bands out there, and they had their own styles. Nobody sounded like this. Nobody. Exactly. And Hallowed Be Thy Name, in 1982, nobody wrote material with that kind of complexity and changes in moods. These days, that's much more the case. I mean, there's some awesome bands that, you know, for example, Opeth are great at cranking it up and taking it down and up and down. This was probably the biggest predecessor to that. And yes, it ends the album. And geez, what a way to end the Number of the Beast album. Again, one of the albums in metal's history with Iron Maiden's strongest song. If I had to pick one song that, you know, to say is Iron Maiden's top dog, this is it. This takes the prize.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you on that. I think this, I mean, honestly, I think this, The Number of the Beast and Acacia Avenue, I mean, not putting Run to the Hills aside, I really love that song too, but I think this, Number of the Beast and Acacia Avenue, for me, I think are the best songs on the album. Definitely, you know, well, the songs that actually define Number of the Beast and, you know, for the album that it really is. So, really, on the whole, this has been a really, really great album that, you know, I can probably listen to day in and day out and still not get bored of it. Because it has this magic and feel to it that, you know, I think very few albums actually have. So, you know, it's basically a classic metal album, and rightfully so. I think this is one of, you know, the greatest albums that, you know, any metal band can definitely ever come up with. And also the artwork of the band, which is just absolutely brilliant, which shows Eddie actually holding the devil as a puppet, you know, and which is so cool. And this cover
art. Oh, talked about that. Yeah, this is, I mean, the album cover. It's the top dog in the history of metal. There's not a better cover.
This is a really, really cool album cover, because I think this is one of the best album covers. Definitely. But, designed by Derek Riggs.
So. Yeah, Derek said, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I can't stand the album covers now. I respect Iron Maiden, of course, but, I mean, come on. Let's get Derek Riggs doing these again. They're definitely way better than anything since him, and this is easily his most famous. And the funny thing is this was actually made for a single of theirs from the Killers album, Purgatory.
Purgatory, exactly. It was actually extended.
No. We're going to use that for the next album. That was a good choice.
They felt that the artwork was so good they could actually use it as their album cover, and rightly so, I think.
They were right.
Decision. Yeah, exactly. A very, very cool decision.
Definitely. Yeah, the that album cover, that got me in so much trouble with my mom. And Mom, I love you. Rest in peace. Iron Maiden's not satanic. Oh, yeah, look at this. And she'd show me that, and I'm like, they just talk about the devil. They're not glorifying him. You know, but then why is he holding puppet strings? You know, and it was the album art itself was a hot topic, you know?
The cool thing about the album cover actually is that
it's holding torches in hell. They're, you know, Bruce is holding that fiery torch standing in hell. So thank you.
And,
thank you,
and the Number of the Beast, if you look at it, the E's are actually, you know, it's a mirrored image of an inverted six. So if you actually turn it upside down, it turns out to be a 666. So that in itself, again, I don't know if the band actually intended to do that, but that's how it actually turns out. I mean, you know, look. So again, very cool album cover. I think definitely one of Maiden's best album covers.
Well, again, this album was a convergence that could never be repeated. And the biggest reason, and we got to kind of keep going back to this, the backbone of this album is Clive Burr's drumming.
Exactly.
Which, again, style-wise, it's the end of an era where you got... It's the end of an era and the beginning of an era. You got the end of Clive Burr's era merging with the beginning of Bruce Dickinson's era, and you got something really special here. And to this day, hearing them played live on the Beast Tour versus, you know, subsequent tours, definitely, I really love when they played these with Clive. I love Nico. I've had the pleasure of meeting him on a number of occasions. I think he's an amazing legend, and I love what they do with him. I gotta be honest here, though, just hearing the way Clive drums these songs, there's just a natural attachment to that, and I think it adds to the album too. For this material, the way he approached this material has a big impact on the feel and the power of the Number of the Beast for that era.
I actually agree with you on that. And you know, again, to show actually how strong of a band Maiden are, I mean, they had to, you know, line up changes one after the other, and I think to keep the consistency and, you know, come out with an album like Peace of Mind right after Number of the Beast, it just shows, you know, the strength of the band. So I definitely think, you know, Maiden had that fire that was like literally burning in them, and that kept pushing them forward. And yeah. I think definitely this you know, proving to be one of Maiden's, you know, greatest albums and classic metal, greatest albums of all time.
And going back to, and you can't imagine, of course, Peace of Mind and Power Slave and so on being played with anyone besides Nico, of course. So again, I'm not suggesting at all that, you know, I can't imagine Clive playing Peace of Mind, or you know what I mean? So it's just kind of one of those.
Precisely, the drumming styles are actually really different from the two albums. So
amazingly different. And of course, what they did on Peace of Mind, which I'm sure we're going to talk about sometime soon, is amazing. And of course, Nico is the perfect piece of that puzzle. But all I'm saying is that some of those Iron Maiden fans I run into who actually to this day prefer the first two albums, for example. I just talked to one the other night. He's like, oh, I prefer the Deano era, the punky sound, this and that. A lot of them, at least to some degree, like this album still because there's that same sense of punk drunkness. And again, that comes down to the drumming. The drumming lends that certain type of energy. It's not better or worse than what they went on to do, but certainly different.
Absolutely. I think all in all, I think the entire band definitely, you know, put a lot of effort into this album. So, and Clive Bow, I mean, even though it was his last album with the band, I think this is definitely, you know, some of the best drumming that you've actually seen, better than that on Iron Maiden and Killers. So all in all, again, like you said, Clive Bow with some fantastic drumming on it. All right, I think we can take a break for 2 minutes. Is there anything that we really need to put in? I mean, apart from the whole track listing and stuff.
Yeah, are we still recording?
Yeah, we're recording. I mean, all this can be
okay. Iron Maiden fans, again, the reason why we're doing this episode is it's episode number 666.
All right, Sean, can I just stop you? Yeah. You know, I think that was just a little coinciding with what I was saying. I mean, I'm going to actually edit and cut this part.
All right. If you Let me say something else.
Start it over.
I want to thank Rowan for choosing the topic he did for this episode. The people that might be new to Iron Maiden, I don't want to be assumptive, but if you have to get your ball rolling on what to have from these guys, this is one of the albums you need to get right away if you don't have. For those of you who have been around the tree a long time with Iron Maiden, what we're saying to you, a lot of which is probably not new, if anything, just a review. Hopefully, you've been entertained by just some of the insight. I will say, as a tribute performer, we do a lot of material from this album. Even when we're not playing the whole thing through, we do in every set list. There's a lot of Beast material. And as a fan, to this day, my favorite Iron Maiden album is The Number of the Beast. And it appears as though that's a lot of fans feel the same way. If it's not their favorite, then it's usually mentioned in the top three. And a very special album. And again, earlier Romain had talked about classic albums. That's a great diatribe dedicated to the making of The Number of the Beast. It's out on video. It's one of the classic album series. That's very entertaining. I happen to have that too. Check that out. And again, if anybody wants to hear how Maiden sounded in 1982, I would highly recommend that you pick up the early days video from Iron Maiden. It's called Iron Maiden, the Early Days, Part 1. And on that, there's a number of songs from the Beast Over Hammersmith gig on video, which will show you what we're talking about. If you want to hear the whole show, then you have the casket set, which I know a lot of fans have. It's a 6-CD set from Iron Maiden, where one of those is the entire Beast Over Hammersmith show. And if you think Live After Death is good, you're right. For those of you that are really into the singing aspect of Iron Maiden, then you'll just be absolutely blown away with how the master Bruce Dickinson sounds at the peak of his vocal powers on that recording. And I must say that The Number of the Beast has been a huge part of my life, just as someone that enjoys music in general. Not too often can you hear something where the music is killer and the singing is killer. A lot of bands have great music, not so good singers. Some bands have pretty good singers, but the music's a little mezza. This moment in 1982, best singer, best music. Nice combination. Thank you, Iron Maiden.
Exactly. I mean, this is definitely one of those albums that, you know, established itself in heavy metal history. And I think, you know, fans would probably enjoy this album to the end of time, because it's definitely one of, you know, the greatest albums that's been put out there, and definitely one of my favorite Maiden albums. So, and definitely, like you said, in the top three. It's not my favorite because Power Slave is, but it's definitely in the top three. So, all in all, a really, really great, episode we have here. I really enjoyed doing this because the Number of the Beast is actually, you know, a topic that I was actually looking forward to doing. And it was episode 6, so, you know, what better?
Rowan, why do I get the feeling I know what's going to be the subject for the 7th episode? I just wonder.
Uh-huh, it's actually a mystery. And sadly enough, I mean, for dedicated fans of this podcast, we're actually going to be taking a break for probably a little time until we're back with episode number 7. So stay tuned.
Yes, we'll see you next week with that.
We try and get this out as fast as we can possibly can. So all in all, again, I think a really great show that we had so fast. So is there anything that you would like to say before we end the podcast?
Yes, I'd like to say that once again, it's been a lot of fun, and I'm very honored to be the co-host of the podcast now. Please go out and get Iron Maiden's brand new CD, The Final Frontier. It's doing well all over the world. And again, we need to just keep supporting Maiden. They're the reason why we're doing this podcast. For those of you, particularly in the Northeast United States, if you want to check us out, we're called Run to the Hills, Iron Maiden Tribute Band. I would recommend you go check us out on Facebook. And if you do that and you like us, click the old like button, and then under our profile photo, there's a wonderful thing called Suggest to Friends. And do that. Click on that and get every Iron Maiden fan you know out there checking us out, because we've been doing this a long time. I won't go into the whole backstory of our band. You can check that out with the, you know, photos of us hanging with the real Maiden, etc. But we appreciate all your support. But again, keep supporting Iron Maiden wherever you are in the world. The easiest way to do that is buy their products, their CDs, and be at their shows and spread the word.
Exactly. Really great way to put it. All in all, I think we've had a really great time doing this episode. And if you like the episode and if you actually want to send your feedback, you can do so by logging onto the website, which is www.theironmaidenpodcast.mypodcast.com, or you can send in your feedback to theironmaidenpodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, so if you want to be up to date with what's happening with the Iron Maiden podcast, you can follow us on Twitter and fan us on Facebook, so, or like us, as it's now called. So either way, we will be back soon for episode number 7. It's a little break, but no harm. So anyway, up the irons.
Up the irons.